You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
But I'd rather begin, you know, 8, 10, want everybody to have time to have coffee and that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, better 10, 15 minutes after 8 than closer to 8:30, because we've got he only has one shot, and then when we break in the morning, that's it. So he's only got that time. And then Steve Rao will be with us after break until lunch. And then after lunch, we'll have Pete Ballard with us. And I'm going to ask the teachers that were with us last year, to think about at 3:30 tomorrow after our break. Susan is coming down and is going to do blackboard workshops for people, and she wants to do it in groups, really hands-on stuff. And the people that were with us last year who've already been involved in Blackboard as part of the online class that they've already taken on the founding, we're going to ask you to maybe take the test on the founding tomorrow during the Blackboard test. That'll be the third administration of that same test. The alternative would be to wait until next year when everybody takes it at the same time, and I don't think that that's really fair to finish a class and then have a test on it a year later. We could do that, I guess, but I don't think that that's really fair. So we may try to get the test in tomorrow, late in the afternoon, while the Blackboard workshop is going on. Yes. Well, I've got. I don't have the first set. I've got the last year's folks, but with the ones that you took last week, we haven't graded yet. They're still here. I've got that in the office. And I can't tell you the truth, I can't remember whether we graded. I know we graded the objective part, but I'm not sure we graded the essays, because Keith and I were both going to look at it. I can't remember whether I got them or whether he's got them.
The Civil War Reconstruction test, is that what you're saying?
No, the one we had the introduction.
Yeah, we did. They took the founding the first time in April, and those tests are there. So we've got three administrations of the test for two groups at different times. So it gets to be, you know, who's on first, if you remember that one. We've got a little bit left on Lincoln, I believe, and so I'm going to turn it over to Carson, and we'll get started.
Okay, thank you, Bill. I do have some more I want to cover on the last section on Lincoln, his presidency, and some of the issues he confronted there, and how he tried to relate those issues back to the founding, or how they did relate back to the founding, whether he wanted to relate them or not. But does anybody have any questions over the material that I covered this afternoon? We kind of just about the time we ended, we had finished the second period of his statesmanship of the 1850s. Anything more I should say about that? Okay, let's go on then. Lincoln's first inaugural address is the first thing I want to discuss, in which he had to deal with the problem of secession. Before I talk about that, however, let me say something about Lincoln's understanding of the Constitution in relation to slavery. I mentioned that quotation about the fugitive slave clause, or provision for fugitive slaves being nominated in the bond. So he meant the Constitution by that remark. He meant to say the Constitution does protect slavery, and we have to respect that. Well, in trying to avert secession, Lincoln did say a lot to try to reassure the South that he had no intention to interfere with slavery in the states where it already existed. And he even went so far in trying to reassure them as to say in that speech that he had no problem with a constitutional amendment guaranteeing slavery in the states where it already existed. Right? And this again goes to the idea that even though he was morally opposed to slavery, and part of his policy was to oppose the extension of slavery, Lincoln didn't think that attacking slavery was worth wrecking the Union on purpose, right? There was a certain distance he was willing to go to accommodate the slave interest. And, you know, the Constitutional Amendment guaranteeing slavery where it already exists seems like a big concession, but as Lincoln explains in this speech, he said I would accept it if it would get them to not leave the Union, because that's what I already believe about the Constitution, right? The Constitution as it stands protects slavery in the states where it already exists. Lincoln was very clear, and this is important to understanding his statesmanship in the Civil War, that he didn't think Congress had any authority over slavery where it existed. The issue to him was its authority over slavery in the territories. Where it existed in existing states, the traditional understanding was Congress could not reach it, the president could not do anything about it, and he didn't have any problem reassuring the Southerners on that point. There's a question or a comment.
If you really meant for a constitutional amendment to be put forth,
mm-hmm.
that would have been like a stall tactic, because it probably would have been ratified by the states.
Well, I don't know.
you could have been thinking, well, between the time that it goes before the states would be ratified, maybe we can work something out before.
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of groping around there because secession on this scale is pretty much unprecedented, and he's trying to say what he thinks needs to be said to keep them in the Union, right? And he was not the mover of that amendment. He says in the speech, I understand that some people in Congress are proposing such an amendment, try to patch things up, and he said, I would not oppose it. The problem is, though, as we can see, that it was too late to really reassure the South on that matter, right? They really believed that they should be able to take slaves into the federal territories, and that slave property was a form of property that should be considered as equal to anybody else's property. So this was a kind of concession that was not enough for them, I think. The other important argument in the first inaugural address is his critique of secession. And he makes a number of arguments here that I like to go over for you. One is that perpetuity, he says, is implied in the fundamental law of all national governments. He says, you will not find any national government anywhere that has a provision in its organic law for its own destruction, right? He understands America as a government, it's a national government, and he thinks that that's incompatible with disunion. Just as a matter of kind of empirical fact, if you observe the way governments behave, when people try to secede, they try to stop them, right? He did it here. The Russians do it with Chechnya, same thing, right? Russians, I think, have sometimes brought that up when Americans complain about human rights abuses in Chechnya. It's like, well, you don't let your people go voluntarily, and we're not letting ours go voluntarily either. They have a memory back to the 19th century. Now, the response to that would be, and you get this from the Southerners, what they would say in response is, Lincoln is misinterpreting what America is. It's not a national government. Lincoln says that. No national government has a provision for its own disunion. And they say in response, but America is not a national government. It's a compact, right? It's an agreement among states to create a confederacy. And really, the whole idea that secession is legal is really, I think, based upon an interpretation of the Constitution as being in strict continuity with the Articles of Confederation. Confederation, all the members are equal, they're all fundamentally sovereign, and they're free to leave when they want to, right? So Lincoln, I mean, there's a defense you could make of that view, although Dr. Cutler mentioned Chief Justice Marshall yesterday as a view that Marshall was at pains to refute. In the passages that Dr. Cutler mentioned, right, where Marshall said, the people of the United States made the Constitution. That was his way of trying to refute the idea that the state governments created the Constitution. It's not a compact among the states. It's an agreement among the people of the United States. Let me make this point real quick. Lincoln does, though, try to engage that argument on his own terms. He says, I don't believe that it's a compact. But even if it were a compact or a contract, people can't get out of contracts unilaterally. Right? He says they may be violated, but they are not undone but by the consent of all the parties. And we're all parties to this, and we don't all consent. The North is not consenting to disunion. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, somebody once said that the epitaph for the Confederacy should read something like this. Here lies the Confederacy that died of states' rights. in other words, the point I'm making, some people have made, how did the South ever think they could construct the Confederate nations on the very philosophy that example, I seem to remember that, for instance, Jefferson Davis had constant arguments with the governors of the state, particularly the governor of Georgia comes to mind.
Yeah.
Joe Brown, am I correct?
I'm not sure, but I mean, I know as a general matter that that's correct. Yeah. No, that's right. The southern states found, especially because they were trying to wage war, right, that war is a centralizing force for governmental power. And Jefferson Davis did have a lot of problems with trying to get the power necessary to apply the force that he thought was necessary to protect the Confederacy from the North. As we'll see in a minute, too, Lincoln argues that there's nothing inherently contradictory in a Confederacy, but Lincoln says secession is a principle of disintegration, right? I'll come to that in a minute. But there's a legalistic argument that he makes here, too. He appeals to the founding against secession. And you kind of have to appeal to these arguments about the spirit of the founding, because it's hard to say. This Constitution doesn't say anything about secession, right? I mean, there's no provision for secession. And there's no prohibition on secession either. So both sides are kind of extrapolate from what they think is the nature of the instrument, the nature of the Constitution. And the Southerners think that it's in the nature of a compact. Lincoln thinks it's something else. He does have this textual evidence, though. This is kind of a clever argument, sort of a lawyer's argument. It wasn't enough to convince the Southerners. But he goes back and says, the Articles of Confederation, the real title of the Articles of Confederation, you can go look it up, is Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, right? Perpetual Union. Now, I mean, that's evidence that to the founders, the union of the states was intended to be permanent, no secession. Now, you could respond to that and say, yeah, but the Articles of Confederation were replaced by the Constitution. It doesn't say anything about perpetuity, right? But Lincoln says, the Constitution says in the preamble it's intended to create a more perfect union, right? And a more perfect union cannot be compatible with secession, because if you take away the perpetuity, it's a less perfect union, right? Now, the reason I say it's a lawyer's argument is because it depends upon this metaphysical understanding of union, right? I mean, you could, and perfection. I mean, if you were a Southerner, you could say, well, from a political standpoint, a more perfect union is one that you can get out of, right? Just like, I don't know, I mean, a lot of people today would say, the marriage laws are better because you can get divorced as opposed to impossibility of divorce, right? Because, you know, maybe it's better to separate in some cases politically as well as domestically. So from a certain standpoint, you could make this argument. But Lincoln's, you know, he's relying on the kind of, like I say, metaphysical or even literal sense of union and perfection, right? In the literal sense, a union is more perfect if it's permanent because it's more a union. It's more unified than it would be otherwise. All right. Let me go on to the message to Congress in special session. Say a little bit more about secession, but then also say something about the issue of habeas corpus. This is a few months later. The message to Congress in special session was delivered on July 4th, 1861. These are different times, right? The president has a power which does not amount to much now, which is to convene Congress in special session. Doesn't amount to much now because Congress is in session all the year round. Back then, they didn't really hold session that often, so he had to call them into a special session to deal with the rebellion. And he makes this further critique of secession where he says, this is the test of democratic government. Right? The question is, can it preserve itself against an obstinate minority that would rather destroy the nation than accept the election's outcome? Right? He says, another way he frames the issue is, must the government be too strong for the liberties of the people or too weak for its own preservation? And he wants to prove that all those things can be compatible, that we can protect the Union and protect people's liberties, but also win the war, which is not just a matter of power politics to him. It's a matter of principle, right? That we won the election, and your guys' response was to leave the Union, right, to try to tear the government apart. And we're going to prove that you can't get away with that. Because if you do get away with it, that will simply prove to the world that any time a sufficiently disgruntled minority loses an election, they can destroy the government. That would be like demonstrating that democratic government can't survive. He makes another point here that also does directly confront the Southern view of the Constitution. He says, secession is based on a belief in the sacred sovereignty of states. He says, what is this supposed mystical sovereignty of the state, as if the state's some kind of fundamental community that enjoys a status that the union doesn't have. And he says there is no such thing. The states don't enjoy this sacred sovereignty. He doesn't deny that they're sovereign in certain limited terms, right? He says they enjoy a certain measure of sovereignty that comes from the Constitution, which is the expression of the people's will. And the people's will is to entrust a certain amount of governmental power to the states. But equally, they've entrusted a certain amount of power to the union, to the government of the union, the federal government. So both really derive their power, their sovereignty, from the union, from the Constitution. The states, he says, have no sovereignty except under the Constitution. They try to get out, they're really destroying themselves. And then he does make this other argument that I just noted a minute ago, that secession's a principle of disintegration, right? He says to the southern states, well, what will happen when some of you disagree among yourselves? Will you then secede? And will then there be secession from the seceders and seceding from the seceding from the seceders, right? You can't have a government in this manner. You really can't concede this principle of secession. It undermines all authority, right? And then he makes this argument that comes back to something I emphasized quite a bit this afternoon. He does have a couple of paragraphs where he talks about how American institutions have elevated the human condition. Let me read just a little bit of it. He says, it may be affirmed without extravagance that the free institutions we enjoy, this is actually on page 5 of the handout, have developed the powers and improved the condition of our whole people beyond any example in the world. Of this we now have a striking and an impressive illustration. So large an army as the government has now on foot was never before known without a soldier in it but who had taken his place there of his own free choice. Right? But more than this, there are many single regiments whose members, one and another, possess full practical knowledge of all the arts, sciences, professions, and whatever else is useful or elegant and is known in the world. And there is scarcely one regiment from which there could not be selected a president, a cabinet, a congress, and perhaps a court abundantly competent to administer the government itself. Right? Nor do I say that this is not also true of our late friends and now adversaries in the contest. But if it is, it is so much the better reason why the government which has conferred such benefits on them and us should not be broken up, right? That's kind of a practical but also a moral defense of the Union. You know, he hopes, as I said, that the principles of the Declaration, which are principles of freedom, individual freedom, and the opportunity to improve yourself, will lift burdens from everybody's shoulders and allow everybody to succeed to the extent that they can. And he says that has, in fact, happened. We have an impressive citizenry. Ordinary people are really competent to serve in Congress and even in the executive branch. They might not all be equally good at it, but they're good enough. They're abundantly competent. And we, you know, legal education is dispersed enough that you could get a court, a Supreme Court from different regiments in the Union. That's an impressive accomplishment. If you look back at Europe, this is kind of the background to his remarks. He doesn't actually say this, but look at Europe. You have in those aristocratic states a small minority of people who are extremely well educated and a large majority of people who are totally ignorant, right? Large majorities of people who simply do physical labor, serfs, peasants, what have you, and they are not competent to govern themselves. We have given everybody a chance to participate in self-government, and as a result, through their own efforts, they become better able. And that's an impressive achievement, and we shouldn't want to destroy the government that created that possibility. And the South, he goes on to say, won't really be able to do that any further if they get out of the Union, because they will be seceding precisely in order to repudiate that principle of freedom and to keep slavery. All right, let me see where we go next. Also, we're shifting gears here to a different issue, but this is also in the message to Congress in special session. Habeas corpus was suspended by Lincoln early in the Civil War. Congress later backed him up on the suspension. Does anybody know what habeas corpus is? Well, yeah, go ahead. Right, it's a very ancient kind of common law protection that goes back into British law that says exactly what you just said. If habeas corpus is a writ issued from a court to the executive, and it literally means in Latin, you have the body, right? Produce the body, meaning the body of the prisoner. It means you have to bring the prisoner bodily to the court, So in effect, it means the executive has to answer to a court for why it is detaining a person, right? The court has the authority to say the executive, well, say the prisoner or somebody on the prisoner's behalf petitions for the writ of habeas corpus. Now the court knows that so-and-so is being held, right? And so they issue the writ and say, we know that you have so-and-so. Bring so-and-so before us and explain why he's being held. And what that works out to mean is that the executive can only detain people, can only hold people, if it can charge them with a crime. It can explain why they're being held. Because this person is accused of murder, this person is accused of theft, or something like that. And if you have some kind of minimal evidence, the court will say, okay, continue to hold them, here's the date for the trial, and we'll find out if they're really guilty or not. If they're not, they'll go free. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
A tradition that goes all the way back to the common law. Uh-huh. Key ideas of the whole jury system.
Right.
I was always amazed by that. I don't think there's precedent in history.
America, right. I mean, the writ developed in British history because at some point people were being jailed. Actually, there's an interesting thing about the writ, I'll tell you, that Lincoln doesn't really have to get into, but it's interesting to see how it developed into an individual right. Really, habeas corpus was really a prerogative of the king, because the argument was the court's answer to the king, and the king has a right to know why any of his subjects are detained. And this goes back to, like, in the common law, things like, you know, maiming somebody, that was a crime, not only because it was a harm to the person maimed, but because it was a harm to one of the king's subjects, right? But it gradually developed to the point where it was exercised against the king, right? And the courts were saying, we can independently inquire into somebody that the king's detaining. Now, this turns out to be revolutionary and highly criticized because Lincoln did it primarily because he did it on his own authority. Let me explain how the controversy develops by discussing Chief Justice Taney's opinion in Ex Parte Merriman, which is the case that involves suspension of habeas corpus, or the first one and the one that's most useful for illustrating this controversy. Now, this is also, again, Chief Justice Taney, but here he is Judge Taney, because at the time, justices of the Supreme Court also served as circuit court judges. So this case, Ex Parte Merriman, did not come before the Supreme Court. It came before the District Court of Maryland, where Taney was sitting as a judge. And, you know, Merriman was a guy who, John Merriman, who was suspected of sympathy with the Confederate cause and of organizing against the Union Army. He lived in Maryland. And General Cadwallader, I think, on Lincoln's authority, suspended habeas corpus and arrested him, right? So this guy's being held by the Union Army at some fort. I can't remember the name of the fort off the top of my head. In any case, he petitioned for habeas corpus. He contacted Taney and told him, I'm being jailed here without being charged of any crime. And Taney, basically got in touch with the general and said, what's going on? And the general said, the guy's a traitor, and we're going to keep him. And I'll talk about the argument in a minute, but the facts are kind of striking themselves. I mean, Taney basically tried to order the man's release, and the general said, look, I'm the general commanding here, and I've suspended habeas corpus, and the president told me I could suspend habeas corpus, so take a walk. I'm not giving the man up, you know. And when it's like a marshal for the court versus the Union Army, you can see who's going to win, right? I mean, you can't really go in there and use force to get Merriman released if the executive's not willing to release him. So Taney wrote this opinion on the case, which he sent to Lincoln and filed in the court records, protesting the suspension of habeas corpus and making arguments for why Lincoln ought not to have done it. Now, here's a key point. The controversy is entirely over Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus, because nobody can deny that you can suspend habeas corpus somehow. It's in Article 1 that habeas corpus may be suspended. Lincoln points this out. The protection for habeas corpus is framed as a right to suspend it, if you want to read it that way. What it says is, except in cases of rebellion or invasion where the public safety shall require it, habeas corpus shall not be suspended, right? Or habeas corpus shall not be suspended except in cases of rebellion or invasion. So there is a power to suspend habeas corpus under the Constitution. The question is, who can do it, right? And Taney's whole argument in this little opinion in Ex Parte Merriman is, that the executive may not do it. Only Congress could do it. And Congress didn't do it. Lincoln did it on his own authority while Congress was not even in session. By the way, just as an aside, most cases, as you know, will be so-and-so versus so-and-so, right? Ex parte cases are very often habeas corpus cases. It's a kind of formulation that's used when the person about whom the case is being conducted is not even present, right? And Merriman couldn't be present because he was off in a Union dungeon somewhere with the Union Army. So what is this argument about who can do it? Taney's argument is only Congress could conceivably properly suspend habeas corpus. And he makes three arguments about this that I think are interesting. One is the British background on habeas corpus. By the time you get to a mature understanding of this in British practice, he says, only Parliament suspends habeas corpus. The King cannot suspend habeas corpus. He makes a big deal out of this, and he points out, if the President can suspend habeas corpus, he has more power over individual liberties than the King had 200 years ago, right? Because only Parliament does it. The executive doesn't do it. And this is part of the background of the American Revolution, right? Of course, they were making a revolution against Britain, but at the same time, all the American founders were British subjects, who were used to British common law. A lot of them were lawyers who were trained in the common law. They read Blackstone. Blackstone would say, and he does say, Taney quotes Blackstone, who's the great English commentator on the common laws at the time of the founding, who says, only Parliament can suspend habeas corpus, not the King. And so Taney brings all that up to say, how likely is it that the founders wanted to make a constitution that was less protective of the individual rights of the citizen than the British Constitution is? Not likely. He also refers to founding era practice. This is a lot easier to explain. He refers to the treasonous plot of Aaron Burr, right? And he points out that when Jefferson was dealing with that, Jefferson sent a message to Congress recommending that they suspend habeas corpus to deal with this plot, because these guys are dangerous and might need to be detained and arrested. The point is, Jefferson did not act as if he could suspend habeas corpus. He asked Congress to do it. And then last of all, he talks about the text of the Constitution. Constitution's divided into a number of articles. Article 1 deals with the powers of, does anybody know? The legislature. Article 2 deals with the powers of the executive, right, the president. And Article 3 is with the judicial or the court. So Taney says the power to suspend habeas corpus is in Article 1, Section 9, right, under the denied powers, but it also is kind of a power of the Congress. He says, read Article 2 dealing with the executive branch. There's not one word about habeas corpus in Article 2. The reasonable thing to conclude is that the power to suspend habeas corpus is a legislative power, just in the context of the Constitution itself. So he's got the text on a reasonable interpretation. He's got American practice. He's got the British background. He thinks it's a slam dunk case. And he says, basically, I'm shocked that I would even have to issue this opinion. I don't think anybody ever thought the president could suspend habeas corpus. But here he's done it. And he ends by saying, I'm powerless to do anything about it because I'm nobody compared to the president in terms of raw power. But I'm leaving my opinion on the books so that everybody knows that what Lincoln has done was unlawful. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I've always been intrigued by that version. In terms of the three branches of government, Article 1 dealing with the legislative branch, is far more lengthy, and they spent more time at the Constitutional Convention creating Article 1, and really very little time in the presidency. Can you interpret that to mean that the original intent was they believed the legislative branch was to be the most important branch? Did you interpret it that way?
Well, in a way, I mean...
Am I making any sense at all?
Yeah. I mean, I think You don't want to say it's the most, I don't want to say necessarily it's the most important branch, because part of the theory of separation of powers is that they're all equal,
right?
They're all equal in their own sphere. But on the other hand, it's hard to deny that the executive and judicial branches are in some ways ministerial to or subordinate to the legislative power, because...
And they're almost afterthoughts.
Well, but what does it mean to execute? What are you executing? The law, right? The judicial branch enforces and interprets the law. So they're all kind of responding to the legal landscape that's created by Congress, which is why and it's also the case that when we speak of Article 1, Section 8, sometimes and equally correctly, sometimes we speak of it as listing the powers of the government. Sometimes we speak of it as listing the powers of the Congress, because in some ways the powers of the Congress are the powers of the government, right? They legislate. They create the laws. There's not a lot the president can do, especially domestically, without laws to enforce, right? He gets a lot of his power from the law, whereas Congress gets to create the laws. Well, what does Lincoln say in response to this? This is also in the message to Congress in special session. He makes two arguments. And the first one is maybe a little bolder, but then he kind of backs off of it and goes to the second one. Let me read a little bit, and I'll first read some, then I'll comment, then I'll read some more. In the middle of this message, he says, "Soon after the first call for militia, it was considered a duty to authorize the commanding general in proper cases, according to his discretion, to suspend the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, or in other words, to arrest and detain without resort to the ordinary processes and forms of law such individuals as he might deem dangerous to the public safety. This authority has been purposely been exercised, but very sparingly. Nevertheless, the legality and propriety of what has been done under it is questioned, and the attention of the country has been called to the proposition that one who is sworn to take care that the laws be faithfully executed should not himself violate them," right? So that's what people are saying about Lincoln. You took an oath to uphold and defend the law, and now you're violating the Constitution itself, really, by suspending habeas corpus. So Lincoln responds, "Of course, some consideration was given to the questions of power and propriety before this matter was acted upon. The whole of the laws which were required to be faithfully executed were being resisted and failing of execution in nearly one-third of the states. Must they be allowed to finally fail of execution, even had it been perfectly clear that by the use of the means necessary to their execution, some single law made in such extreme tenderness of the citizen's liberty that practically it relieves more of the guilty than of the innocent, should to a very limited extent be violated? To state the question more directly, are all the laws but one to go unexecuted, and the government itself to go to pieces, lest that one be violated? Even in such case, would not the official oath be broken if the government should be overthrown, when it was believed that disregarding the single law would tend to preserve it?" Right? So this is what I call here an appeal to prerogative. The prerogative in America, well, in, say, British history and British political thought, like in John Locke, who's one of the founder's favorite philosophers, talks about the prerogative authority. It's an authority to act in the absence, I'm going to make this more clear, it's an authority of the executive, right? An authority of the executive to act in the absence of law or even against the law for the sake of the public safety or the common good. That's what Locke says. So that's important because this gives a certain buttressing to Lincoln's point. You could defend him in this way. The founders were students of Locke. Locke is second to nobody in his insistence upon the rule of law, right? But even Locke says there can be emergencies where the executive will have to act outside the law. And there will be even emergencies where the executive has to act against the law. And they'll have to be judged as extraordinary cases, right? And Lincoln wants to say something like that is going on here. You say I'm obligated by my oath to uphold the Constitution. I am. I'm obligated to uphold the whole Constitution, right? And if it requires that I violate one part to save the whole, wouldn't that be more consistent with the oath? Because it's just part of the government's job to protect the public safety, and it's going to be done one way or the other, whether it's strictly legal or not. And this makes a certain amount of sense, right? Like, imagine a less developed society where there are not that many laws, like England, maybe back then. If a fire breaks out in London and is consuming some house, and London's the kind of town where every house is right next to every other house, right? And some executive officer says, tear that house down and tear down the houses on either side of it. I mean, in some sense, that's an illegal act, right? I mean, it's destruction of property, blah, blah, blah. Either it's against the law or there's no law authorizing it, right? But again, the whole community would say that was a reasonable thing to do, right? That was an act of prerogative. And Lincoln wants to defend himself to some extent on that ground. Say, of course, habeas corpus is important, but we're in an extraordinary situation here. We had to act to preserve the whole Constitution, not just that one part. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Rearming of America and helping Britain. Why he didn't go that far.
Uh-huh.
He theoretically, in some ways, violated the spirit of the law, and it turned out the same way that he actually helped the country by doing that.
And it's a little bit different there. I mean, there's similarities. The one difference, though, would be he got Congress to enact laws for him, right? That were the Supreme Court said were outside the usual constitutional powers. So there had to be, I mean, he was being aggrandized, but by Congress, whereas Lincoln acted without congressional authorization. And the argument was that the FDR Congress was really acting beyond the commerce power of the federal government.
Congress had given him the authority if he would have went to
them. Lincoln? Well, they ratified it after the fact. Once they got in, part of what they did in the special session was to pass the Habeas Corpus Act, which provided for suspension. So they did ratify it after the fact. Now, however, I don't want to leave it at this because Lincoln doesn't rely on that argument alone. And here's how I read this. He floats that argument, but then he kind of backs away from it and says, that really is not the argument I want to rely on. Because he goes on and says, after having said all that, he says, but it was not believed that this question was presented. In other words, hypothetically, if I had to violate the law to save the whole Constitution, wouldn't that be okay? But I don't think that's what happened in this case. He says it was not believed that any law was violated. Now, how can that be? If it's in Article 1 and it's clear that Congress alone shall suspend habeas corpus, well, Lincoln is a careful reader of the law, too. He says the provision of the Constitution that, quote, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it, close quote, is equivalent to a provision, is a provision, that such privilege may be suspended when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety does require it. It was decided that we have a case of rebellion and that the public safety does require the qualified suspension of the privilege of the writ which was authorized to be made. So far, in other words, although the Constitution protects habeas corpus, it also does mention suspension. So, fair enough. But that's a little bit not totally to the point, because the question is who can do it. So he goes on and says, but the Constitution, it is insisted that Congress and not the executive is vested with this power. But, says Lincoln, the Constitution itself is silent as to which or who is to exercise the power. And as the provision was plainly made for a dangerous emergency, it cannot be believed that the framers of the instrument intended that in every case the danger should run its course until Congress could be called together, the very assembling of which might be prevented, as was intended in this case, by the rebellion. Right? In other words, it is true that the suspension provision is in Article 1, which is dedicated to Congress. But it doesn't say habeas corpus shall not be suspended except when Congress judges that rebellion or state of insurrection exists. It's in the passive language, right? Habeas corpus shall not be suspended, or the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be infringed except in cases of blah, blah, blah. So it doesn't mention, like Lincoln says, it doesn't say exactly who would do it. And that leaves enough of an opening for him to say, I think it's equally plausible to say the executive could do it, right? Or maybe the executive can do it when Congress is not in town, right, where the emergency seems to require it. Because, as he points out there, a rebellion or an invasion might prevent Congress from ever assembling. Are we going to say that if you're that successful in your rebellion, you can totally disarm the government by stopping it from taking all measures that could preserve itself? He doesn't think that's practical or reasonable.
What about today?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, seems to me that the recent Supreme Court opinions on this have suggested that Lincoln was wrong and that they don't think it's an executive power. Although we haven't had that kind of emergency again since. Like every other time we've wanted to deal in a heavy-handed way where we thought public safety was threatened, Congress really has authorized things. Now, during the last decade, there's no effort to suspend habeas corpus, but there's other things you can do, and this would be the kind of thing that some people were troubled by. I mean, habeas corpus is a protection, originally understood, I think, as a protection for citizens of the United States, right, and people who are here domestically. So the question then arises, could the executive simply declare people to be enemy combatants, right? Because that's kind of what the Bush administration did with some of the terror suspects. Say, well, you're an enemy combatant, right? You've been captured in the context of war. Habeas corpus doesn't apply to enemy combatants because they're not being held in such a way as to even be, even to have access to the courts, you know. So it's still kind of a live issue in terms of practice, but habeas corpus has not been suspended much since the Civil War. Yeah.
As I listen to you in a very quick explanation, also, though, what we've seen, you mentioned Bush since World War II, where presidents are changing the country. And I'm not so sure that some of them don't sort of fit in that Lincoln mold where we know better than Congress does what is in the national interest in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, I just, you know, when you talk about, very good talk about this, and the way Lincoln interprets
And, you know, some people who are critical of Lincoln think that he is sort of like the harbinger of extreme executive power, right? And it is a live issue because, and it's one maybe where Lincoln is, you could raise a question about his own consistency because, remember, he was a critic of the war with Mexico, as we talked about earlier, and his law partner, Billy Herndon, was in favor of the war with Mexico, and there's an exchange of letters, and Lincoln was kind of basically said, look, Herndon, your position is that the president can take us to war whenever he says it's necessary, whenever he says there's a threat of invasion, right? And he has to decide, and there's nothing we can do about it. He says, I think that's a monarchical power. We could never tolerate that. Now, you don't, I mean, it's pretty indisputable that there is a rebellion in Lincoln's case, so he doesn't quite totally do a reversal, but he does exercise a lot of executive power, which is not maybe what you'd expect after you read what he said as a Whig in 1848. But yeah, it's still a living issue because this whole Libya intervention raises the question, right? And it's all the more troubling because it's being done by a liberal Democrat who's a supporter of the war powers resolution and everything. But, you know, we kind of waging some executive warfare there in Libya. Now, it's a very limited engagement, but at the same time, you know, members of Congress of both parties and both wings of both parties, like conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats like Dennis Kucinich, are concerned about that because it seems like an executive power to wage war, whereas, well, let's say it'd be better of me to say an executive power to initiate war, because clearly once war is declared, the executive does wage it. He's commander-in-chief. The question is, can the executive get us into a war, having not been in one? And that looks like it might be more of a congressional power, because Article 1 says the power to declare war is a congressional power. And the reason, by the way, this is the last thing I'll say about this, is, though, that it's possible to have these debates because the Constitution is ambiguous about certain things, right? To be commander-in-chief is clearly to have a war power. The power to declare war is clearly a war power. And there's all this kind of twilight zone in between where it's not clear who has power to do what. If another nation attacked America's forces, the president would be on very secure ground in ordering some kind of counterattack, even absent a declaration of war, right? So that's a relatively easy case, but then you get, you know, back into these other cases like, you know, he thinks America's threatened in its interests or in its values or something like that. Does he have the right to use force? That gets more problematic.
I always had the sense that some political science scientists and historical scientists, they, in terms of what they intended, and their argument is that the president has a right to take this country into an undeclared war if our national territory is threatened. As an act which will stand on its own until Congress gets back in session and declares war.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this idea that the president has the right to have wars of choice,
yeah,
as Stanley was talking about the other day, is completely outside the Constitution. Or that's the interpretation, their intentions,
mm-hmm,
that the commander-in-chief, say, just hypothetically, we were attacked from Canada, well, and Congress is not in session. He would have a right to respond, but never defending that right that he's taken upon himself.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think that's right, because if we were attacked by Canada and if they took some territory or something, it seems to me the war question would in the end rest with Congress,
yeah,
if they could convene. In other words, if Congress wanted to say, well, we don't think it's worth it to fight a war, let's just concede whatever they took as long as it wasn't very much, well, then the president wouldn't really have any business continuing to wage the war,
yeah,
at that point. Well, this...
Sort of a self-defense act.
Yeah, yeah, which is implied. And again... You know, not everything, the Constitution doesn't spell out everything. Like, again, I keep going back to Dr. Cutler. Yesterday he said, it's important that Marshall said in McCulloch, we have to remember it's a Constitution we're expounding, not a code of law. A lot of stuff is left to implication, reasonable interpretation of the document. You can't spell out every possible contingency. Yeah, go ahead.
I've heard it on this subject. I've heard it argued that Lincoln usurped more power than any president before or since. How would you contend on that question?
Hold on a second. Do we need to be passing the microphone around? Let's answer this one first. So the question is, did Lincoln usurp more power than any president before or since? I mean, Lincoln wouldn't want to say that, right? Because it's, you know, that whole, you could make an argument that, look, Lincoln makes all this noise in the perpetuation address about the need to respect the law, but then he arrogates all this power to himself in the Civil War. Isn't that inconsistent? Well, Lincoln was aware of that criticism, and he tried very hard to find a legal argument for everything he did. It doesn't say he always had the best possible legal argument, but the very desire to make legal arguments already shows a certain kind of restraint that I think is admirable. In other words, Lincoln was not so barefaced to say, look, it's a civil war, there's no rule of law until we win, then we'll reestablish the rule of law. Meanwhile, we do everything we can to win. He never said anything like that. He always tried to say, there is a legal justification for what I'm doing. And, you know, I think once Congress was around, he was on pretty good ground because, again, when they issued the suspension of habeas corpus, they authorized what he did. It clearly was a case of rebellion or invasion. Not invasion, but rebellion, which then involved invasions later on. So I think, I don't know, I wouldn't want to say that he usurped power, but when you have, here's another way of addressing it. Some people who criticized Lincoln in his day said, you know, are you trying to tell us that the Constitution is different sometimes than it is from other times? And he said, no, it's different in its application, depending upon the circumstances. The Constitution contemplates war. When war exists, it calls into being certain powers that are implied in the Constitution. When a rebellion exists, that calls into being certain extraordinary powers, but they are part of the Constitution. Now, the executive has grown in its authority a lot, even since Lincoln, but a lot of that's due not to executive usurpation, but to Congress just handing the power over, creating a big administrative state with lots of delegated authority to the executive. And we have another question down here, so let's go ahead and pass the mic.
My question was very basic. When you was talking about presidential powers, it basically the idea that the president can declare war, but he has to ask Congress to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that basically just how the system works there?
Well, I mean, that's what we're getting to, although I think that's not really consistent with the Constitution, because the Constitution says Congress shall declare war. But we have gotten into situations where the hostilities have been kind of initiated by the president, and then what is left for Congress but to refuse funding, right? But then that gets to be a delicate matter because once troops are in the field and are in danger, no Congress wants to refuse them the funding they need. So, do you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, just one thing. I teach a course on the Vietnam War. One of the big questions about that was the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1974,
yeah,
where by a vote of 98-0 in the Senate and total majority in the House of Representatives,
Lyndon Johnson was given a blank check, in a sense. But somebody, and I'm not getting scatological, somebody said that in that act, Congress literally cut off its you-know-what, and they've been trying to sew them back on since then.
Yeah.
They have never succeeded in sewing themselves back on since then.
Yeah, and it's, you know, just let me add this, though. It's complicated by politics, though, because presidents now seem to be in a constitutional, well, in a practical constitutional position where Congress will follow them. But at the same time, politics sometimes leads presidents to seek congressional approval, even if they don't ask for declarations of war, because they want cover, so to speak, right? If the thing goes bad, you want to make sure that you're not the only one responsible for it. So, you know, even President Bush, who did try to assert a more expansive understanding of the executive power, he did go to Congress to get resolutions, not declarations of war, but like force resolutions in Afghanistan and in Iraq, you know, something. It's something.
The War Powers Act after that to deal with that very specific question.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's at issue in Libya, too. All right, well, let me go on here and talk about a little bit more about habeas corpus domestically. There's this very interesting letter Lincoln wrote to Erastus Corning and others in 1863, and they had written to him. These guys were Ohio Democrats who were criticizing Lincoln's, what they would say would be his abuse of civil liberties during the Civil War under the suspension of habeas corpus. And they make a couple of complaints. They observe that people have been arrested who have violated no established law of the United States. They're just arrested on executive authority. For what reason? We don't know, right? So people are being arrested without being charged of violations of law. And they also make the argument that you're doing this all over the place. Yet the Constitution would contemplate only that habeas corpus could be suspended in the locality of rebellion. You know, it'd be one thing to be arresting people, you know, in Kentucky or Virginia or someplace where the war is raging, but you're arresting people in Indiana and Ohio and places like that. And Lincoln's response is pretty striking and tough, because he does not back down at all from the suspension of habeas corpus. I don't think he says it in this letter, but in another one, but let me give you this quotation. Somebody complains about violations of rights, like people are being arrested because of things they have said, right, newspaper editorials that are critical of the Union cause. Or in this letter, he does mention people who try to incite desertion from the army. Well, you could view that as an exercise of freedom of speech, right? If you're making, and he actually, Lincoln frames it in those terms. He says people go to these meetings and they make speeches against the Union cause, and they work on the feelings of the mothers and fathers and get them to write to their sons and say desert, and then those sons desert and the Union army is weaker than it was. So he's clearly talking about trying to control certain amounts of freedom of speech through the suspension of habeas corpus. And the striking quotation that, again, it's not in this letter, but in a different one, he says, you complain about these people's rights being violated that are in the Constitution. He says, look, suspension of habeas corpus is de facto the suspension of every other right, right? So sometimes people talk about Lincoln as a dictator during the Civil War. Now, that's pretty strong language. And one big thing you can say in Lincoln's defense, despite all the powers he exerted, is he went ahead and had an election in 1864, right? I mean, if a guy were really a tyrant, he might try to suspend the election. But Lincoln never tried to do that or suggested anything like that. And indeed, it would be inconsistent with everything he said that he stood for, because he said this is a contest to see if democratic self-government can prevail. If I don't win the re-election, I'm going to relinquish the office, right, would be his attitude. But within the confines of the office, while he still holds it, he's willing to exercise every power. And he says, well, he more or less admits, this is me now, not him, but if you say suspension of habeas corpus is the suspension of every other right, you're admitting that you're acting as a dictator to a certain extent, right? Because you can arrest people for whatever reason you want to, not because they're guilty of a crime, but because you think they're dangerous. And he admits this in the letter to Erastus Corning and others. He says, the very purpose of suspension of habeas corpus is to let the executive arrest people who have violated no law, right? What did the person do that was wrong? Well, it's hard to say. I just think he's dangerous, would be the executive response. And he uses this, he makes this distinction that I've illustrated here with these bullet points. He says, the process of regular courts of law is vindictive. Suspension of habeas corpus arrests are preventive, meaning that what ordinarily happens in normal times when we're dealing with ordinary crime that the civil courts are set up to deal with is so-and-so commits a murder, so-and-so commits theft. You arrest him, put him in jail, put him on trial. You prove that they're guilty. That's a punishment after the fact for what has been done, right? And that is sufficient to protect the society under ordinary conditions because they're really, you know, we have more crime or less depending on social conditions, but really the ordinary crime of peacetime is not enough to threaten the very society. But when you have rebellion or invasion, it's not enough to punish people after the fact. You've got to punish them. Well, that's not even right. It's not even punishment. You have to restrain them before the fact. That's the whole point of suspending habeas corpus, is to arrest people who you think are dangerous to the cause of the government, and to stop them. In fact, he has this passage I will read here, a little bit of it. He says, "Of how little value the constitutional provision I have quoted will be rendered if arrests shall never be made until defined crimes have been committed may be illustrated by a few notable examples." Here they are. General John C. Breckinridge, General Robert E. Lee, General Joseph E. Johnston, General John B. Magruder, General William B. Preston, General Simon B. Buckner, and Commodore Franklin Buchanan, now occupying the very highest places in the rebel war service, were all within the powers of the government since the rebellion began and were nearly as well known to be traitors then as now. Unquestionably, if we had seized and held them, the insurgent cause would be much weaker, but no one of them had then committed any crime defined in the law. Every one of them, if arrested, would have been discharged on habeas corpus were the writ allowed to operate, right? But it would have been better had they been detained, he says, because then we'd have them where they couldn't do any harm. And again, that's the whole point of suspending habeas corpus, to stop harm to the society in these extraordinary emergencies. He also, as an aside, before I get off that point, makes kind of a common sense moral defense of himself, which is also worth noting. He says, if a soldier boy deserts from the Union Army, what happens to him? Stand up a wall against a wall and shoot him, right? Execution for desertion. And he says, are you telling me that I can't touch a single hair on the head of the wily agitator who induces him to desert, but him I have to execute, right? You got people making speeches, trying to induce desertion. I can't touch them because of freedom of speech, but I have to execute the guys who actually do desert. He says, I don't think that's reasonable, right? I'm going to go after these guys first and prevent the desertions in the first place. As to the second criticism, again, as he did with the suspension itself, he says, let's look at the text very carefully, right? You guys tell me it's not right. You think that people are being arrested without charges all over the country. Suspension should be limited to locality of rebellion. And Lincoln says, the Constitution doesn't say that. It doesn't say anything about the locality of the rebellion. It says where the public safety requires it. And he says, basically, I will arrest anybody anywhere the public safety requires it. I don't care if they're in New York or what. And he has a good point there, too. I mean, I know this is a kind of shockingly expansive interpretation, but as a lot of you guys know, there were riots against the draft in New York and stuff like that. There were people who basically were doing things that would impede the Union cause. And even though New York is a long way away from any fighting in the Civil War, it's a scene of actions that could definitely impede the Union cause. And so Lincoln was willing to, you know, draw every power he thought was necessary to protect the Union. Let's go on to another issue here. Emancipation. Lincoln kind of, you might say he evolved on emancipation of the slaves, or it might be more along his way of thinking to say that the circumstances had to evolve before he could emancipate the slaves. Initially, Lincoln was very reluctant to act with regard to emancipation. And not only did he not act, he countermanded the actions of those who did act. That's a picture of General John C. Fremont, right, who was a Union general. He's also the Republican nominee for the presidency in 1856. And Fremont was an ardent abolitionist. And in the context of his command, which I think was in Missouri, he freed slaves. He issued a proclamation freeing the slaves within his military command under Lincoln, right? And Lincoln countermanded it, right? And he got criticized. What are you doing? I thought you were against slavery, Lincoln. I thought part of the purpose of the war was to be against slavery. And Lincoln has to explain why he countermanded Fremont's order. And he makes a constitutional argument and a political argument. And this, I think I will read, because it's worth it. to Browning, Lincoln says, "General Fremont's proclamation as to confiscation of property and the liberation of slaves is purely political and not within the range of military law or necessity. If a commanding general finds it necessary to seize the farm of a private owner for a pasture, an encampment, or a fortification, he has the right to do so, and so to hold it as long as the necessity lasts. And this is within military law because within military necessity. This ordinarily happens, right? You're fighting a war, go to somebody's house and say, okay, I'm sorry, this is going to be my headquarters, you know, for the next month or something like that. I have no problem with that," Lincoln says. "But," he adds, "to say that the farm shall no longer belong to the owner or his heirs forever, and this as well when the farm is not needed for military purposes as when it is purely political, without the savor of military law about it. And the same is true of slaves. If the general needs them, he can seize them and use them, like to build fortifications or something like that. But when the need is past, it is not for him to fix their permanent future condition. That must be settled accordingly to laws made by lawmakers and not by military proclamations. The proclamation in the point in question is simply dictatorship. It assumes that the general may do anything he pleases, confiscate the lands and free the slaves of loyal people as well as disloyal ones. And going the whole figure, I have no doubt, would be more popular with some thoughtless people than that which has been done. But I cannot assume this reckless position, nor allow others to assume it on my responsibility. You speak of it as being the only means of saving the government. On the contrary," Lincoln says, "it is itself the surrender of the government. Can it be pretended that it's any longer the government of the U.S., any government of constitution and laws, wherein a general or a president may make permanent rules of property by proclamation?" Right? So he's not willing to do it because it's got to be done in relation to military necessity, right? And it just wasn't done that way here. And later on, when Lincoln does it, he tries to do it in relation to military necessity, as we'll see. We can ask the question whether he's consistent here too, though. He goes on and talks about the political problem. The political problem is, by doing this, Fremont is alienating necessary support for the Union. He says in this letter, "I have it on good authority from people I trust that there were regiments in Kentucky that threw down their arms when they heard about the proclamation," right? These are guys in border states who are saying, look, we're fighting to preserve the Union. We're not fighting to have our own slaves taken away from us. So he had to think about that as well. As Lincoln said there, "I can't allow other people to assume this reckless position on my authority." He had another interesting exchange with Horace Greeley on emancipation. Horace Greeley was the editor, I think, of the New York Tribune, abolitionist, and he wrote this letter criticizing Lincoln. It's like about a year into the war. It's like, it's unclear what the policy is. Why are you dithering around? That kind of thing. And here's what Lincoln said in response to Greeley. I think, again, in an open letter, he said, "As to the policy I'm pursuing, as you say, I have not meant to leave anyone in doubt." And so this is pretty famous. You may have heard this before. Lincoln says to Greeley, "I would save the Union. I would save it the shortest way under the Constitution. The sooner the national authority can be restored, the nearer the Union will be, the Union as it was. If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union and not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all slaves, I would do that. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about the about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I don't believe it would help to save the Union." And he goes on to say, you know, this is what I'll be guided by. And we can also ask whether the Emancipation Proclamation is consistent with that. He concludes by saying, "I have here stated my purpose according to my view of official duty. I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free." Right? Lincoln was opposed to slavery. But again, even in the context of Civil War, he didn't think he had a lot of authority to do anything about slavery where it existed. Right? Other than as, well, no constitutional authority other than through military necessity, right? If you're fighting the war and you're in Louisiana or someplace like that, you can seize people's slaves, right, and use them. But as far as making permanent rules of property goes, not so clear the executive could do that. Did you want to add something or ask?
Yeah, I've always been amazed when I used to get arguments with some of my Civil War laws about the Emancipation Proclamation, because somehow they think that the Emancipation Proclamation actually freed slaves.
Mm-hmm.
The British had very interesting that where Lincoln could have freed slaves in the border states, he didn't. And when he, where he had no power to free slaves in the South, he did.
Yeah.
And it ended up no slaves.
And
it's amazing how this mythology is
right.
Grown up.
Well, let's talk about that. Well, I mean, it brings me to the Emancipation Proclamation, and even Seward said the same thing, I believe. It's like, look, we're saying we're going to free them where we don't have any authority over them, and we're not going to free them where we do. The Emancipation Proclamation is very carefully crafted to be an act of military necessity, or at least Lincoln tried to craft it that way. And the image on the right shows where the Emancipation Proclamation was supposed to be in force, right? And Lincoln very carefully in the language says, and that's the image of it in Lincoln's writing, he says, you know, we're going to emancipate the slaves in areas of the country that are in rebellion against the government, right? And so that amounts to all these states of the Confederacy, not the border states that stayed in the Union, and a little bit of Louisiana there that was under the control of the Union at the time. And so, yeah, the obvious question is like, well, why are you doing that, right? I mean, how come you're not emancipating all the slaves? Is this a sign of Lincoln's hypocrisy or his unconcern about slavery? Well, he would say, no, it's not. It's a sign of my obedience to the law. I don't have authority. I mean, Lincoln didn't believe that Congress had authority to emancipate slaves where slavery was lawfully established in the states. So far less did he believe that he, as president, could do it, right? As he said in the letter to Browning, it's got to be done by law, right? Well, executives don't make laws, they execute laws, so he doesn't have any authority to do that, unless it's a military necessity, right? There is such a thing as military law. Everybody knows that under military law, property can be seized for use, right? Yeah, it's an interesting distinction, right? If an army invades another country in a war and they occupy somebody's house to use as a headquarters, that's just military law. That's the way it goes, right? Now, if they burn the house down just to be terrorizing the population, that might be a war crime or something like that, right? There are limits, but military law is pretty broad. It allows you to take property to use if it's necessary. If you're just burning the crops to oppress the population, that might be a war crime. If you're taking the crops to feed your own army, that's a different thing. So that's what we're going to do with the slaves, right? Now let me ask you guys a question here. It's one worth debating. We've kind of raised these questions about, is Lincoln totally consistent? Here's one that I often wonder about. In the letter about Fremont that we looked at, he said, it would be shocking for the executive to try to make permanent rules of property, right? It's got to be based on military necessity. Now, the Emancipation Proclamation is framed in relation to military necessity. But it also does say this. It says, this is only directed at slaves of disloyal people. But the slaves of disloyal people, he says in the proclamation, shall now and henceforth and forever be free, right? So that's a pretty big step. I mean, that's the one that I wonder, where I think you could argue that, well, Lincoln, did you overstep the limit that you established for yourself? Because here you're it seems like you're making a permanent rule. You're saying, since you have not, basically saying to all those states, since you haven't got back in the Union by the date I established, your slaves are, they're gone, right? We're taking them. And you wonder there if maybe he's not, there are letters where he defends that as being necessary to the Union cause. He says, look, we needed to sap their slave strength. We had to make this promise. The promise being made has to be kept, right? Those slaves are never going back to slavery now. But again, you wonder if it's not, is there a kind of a gray zone or a gray area where military necessity is shading over into political necessity, right? Because you can't free these people and then re-enslave them. That would be too repugnant to Americans themselves. And also, I mean, you might talk about this. There's a diplomatic angle on this too, right?
Well, as I listen to you, one thing that comes to mind, Lincoln, he sure was a hell of a good lawyer. I'll tell you, further commenting on that, they once asked a scientist, what is two and two? He And he says, well, balloon two is four. So they ask a biologist, what's three and two? That's five. Then they ask the lawyer, what is two and two? And he stops and says, what do you want it to be?
Right.
The mental agility of the lawyer never ceases to amaze me.
Well, no, that's okay. But isn't there a diplomatic angle here too, though? That because, that you know, Lincoln knew that. Well, I mean, one of the dangers the Union faced was that European countries, especially England, would recognize the South as an independent country, and he wanted to head that off, right? And one way to head it off was to, he's trying to walk a fine line. Like, if you make the war about slavery, then England will not be able to recognize the Confederacy, I think is his calculation, because public opinion in England will not allow a government to side with a pro-slavery government in a contest over slavery, right, if it's only about that.
Again, I'm stepping on my lines for tomorrow, which is all right. It's funny, the British papers, particularly on the Tory side, I have a cartoon which I'll show you tomorrow, actually saw the Emancipation Proclamation as a last desperate act in the part of Lincoln,
mm-hmm.
and also that it may raise the worst of all things, race war in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't at all, despite what the mythology is, they weren't all convinced that it was going to be workable.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Now, having said that, however, the working class, it resonated very much with them.
Yeah.
Even though we must remember they didn't have a lot of power.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you talk about intervention, non-intervention, mm-hmm. well, intervention, the British government, they would not be guided by the working class, but they had to be conscious of where they were.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the fine line Lincoln had to walk, too, is that it kind of lines up very nicely both politically and legally, because if he makes it simply about obliterating slavery, he would undercut his own position that we're not allowed, we don't have the power to attack it. So he has to make it a matter of military necessity, and he has to make that argument. But it also makes it enough about slavery that people who are interested in abolition can no longer really seriously think about abandoning the Union cause, I don't think.
Northern propagandists in England got a lot of mileage out of that among even the Tories, they would never, you know, would defend slavery. They just sort of looked around and said it's terrible. I mean, England abolished slavery in
1833.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But Lincoln had done a very wise thing. He sent key abolitionists, including, by the way, Frederick Douglass, to England.
Mm-hmm.
To Lincoln, or Douglass had been there previously when he was fleeing from the United States, to drive home that abolitionist argument.
Yeah.
They were very effective.
I just mentioned in passing here, Seward made that same point. Lincoln had the Emancipation Proclamation drafted and ready to go sometime before he issued it, and he talked about it with the cabinet, and the war was not going well militarily, and Seward said, look, if you issue it now, it is going to look like a desperate act. Wait until we win a battle. So Lincoln waited until they won the next big one and issued it. That reminds me of a little side story here on Lincoln that I always like to tell in political science classes. We have, the executive is different from the other branches of government because it basically comes down to one man, right? One person, rather. The president is the person in charge. It's the most perfectly hierarchical branch of government. The Supreme Court does things by a majority vote. The Houses of Congress do things by a majority vote, but there's disputes about what it means to have a unitary executive. Some people associate that with like certain scope of powers. It doesn't really mean that. It just means that there's one executive. Because at the time of the founding, you know, a lot of the states had executive councils and things like that, and they had bad experience with sort of ineffective, weak executives. So the argument at the convention was the executive power will be in the hands of one person because it's the only way to have energy in the executive. There was a cabinet meeting once where Lincoln polled the cabinet on what to do. And they all voted the same way. And Lincoln said, well, that's 5-1. I reckon I win. So I'm the president. Right? Now, did somebody else over here have a question earlier, though? I thought I saw another hand. No? Okay. Well, let me go to a final final point here, the question of Reconstruction. And then I'll have a little bit of time to say some things about some general themes. Okay, well, we already talked about this. I just didn't bring up the slide. Lincoln, as was indicated in an earlier comment, did not get to have a lot to do with Reconstruction because he was assassinated, but he was thinking about the problems of Reconstruction. And this gets to an earlier question as well about how far was Lincoln willing to go with the political equality of the races. Because remember in the 1850s when people would ask him, are you in favor of the political equality of the races? He would say, no, I'm not. Right? And the question comes up, was Lincoln really just against slavery but favored an inferior position for the black race if it could be freed from slavery? You could read him in that way because he says about the Declaration, he treats it as if it just forbids slavery and that's all. You can't enslave people. Now, on the other hand, talk about Lincoln being a good lawyer, he did make the argument in the Missouri Compromise speech that consent of the governed requires that everybody has to give their consent. And that would imply that that even non-enslaved blacks would have to be members of the political community. They have to have the right to vote, right? And so the question then becomes, even though Lincoln disclaimed that implication, did he not really see it for himself, or was it just something he wasn't willing to state publicly, right? I think probably the latter. I think he did believe in political equality if the races lived together, and I get that from this letter that he wrote to Michael Hahn, who was the governor of Louisiana, I should say 1864. Sorry, that's a typo. Hahn was the governor of the new beginning Reconstruction government of Louisiana, and here's what he said to Hahn. In a private letter, this shows Lincoln's care as a politician, too. He said, I congratulate you on having fixed your name in history as the first free state governor of Louisiana. Now, you are about to have a convention, which, among other things, will frame a constitution, and among other things, will probably define the elective franchise. I barely suggest for your private consideration whether some of the colored people may not be let in, as, for instance, the very intelligent and especially those who have fought gallantly in our ranks. They would probably help in some trying time to come to keep the jewel of liberty within the family of freedom. But this is only a suggestion, not to the public, but to you alone. Right? So he is already thinking about granting the right to vote in a limited way to freed African Americans. And he comes out for that publicly in his last public address in 1865 in April, where he talks about the problems of Reconstruction. He mentions Louisiana because it already has kind of an embryonic government. And he's kind of dealing with the political problem that not everybody's satisfied with the way it's going, but his attitude is, you know, let's keep trying with what we have there. It's not perfect, but it'll be easier to get them back into the Union if we continue with the work we've already done. And he does say, it is unsatisfactory to some that the elective franchise is not given to the colored man. He says this on his own. He says, I would myself prefer that it were now conferred on the very intelligent and those who serve our cause as soldiers. Right? So it comes out in public there in the following year and says to everybody, we are going to have, hopefully, a certain measure of political equality. Not complete, because obviously even very ignorant and unlettered whites could vote, right? And Lincoln is saying, you know, just the intelligent Africans and the ones who have fought in the army. But still, that's a step in the direction of political equality, which suggests that it really was something that he understood as a principle all along. By the way, another dramatic moment here. Does anybody know what future famous person was in the crowd listening to that speech? Yep. And when Lincoln said those words, reportedly Booth said, that means black citizenship. It's the last speech he'll ever make. Right? And he acted on that. Go ahead. Well, yeah, really. I don't know. Probably on the basis of educational attainment or something like that. It would be.
Considering the fact they
wouldn't
let the slaves
read. Right, yeah. By the way, Lincoln made a great point about laws against teaching the slaves to read.
Because they could be very intelligent.
Of course.
If they never had the opportunity.
It'd be hard to tell, right? I mean, but this isn't, going back to the 1850s, one of Lincoln's good arguments, talk about the temperance address and how you don't denounce people. Lincoln tried to make arguments against slavery that Southerners themselves could maybe respond to, and one that, couple that you reminded me of one, and it reminds me of another one in addition, is that Lincoln would say in some of his speeches, why is it that in the South you will not shake hands with a slave dealer, right? It's because you know that it's wrong, right? Slave dealers are a detested class in the South. Why? Because you know that it's wrong to deal in human flesh like it's property. You already know it yourself. You already act on that instinct. He also made the point about some of the laws that made it illegal for slaves to read. Lincoln would say, now in the South, do you have laws against teaching wolves to read? No, right? Why not? Because you know they're human beings. It wouldn't be necessary to make it illegal to teach them to read, except that they can read. If they can read, that means they're capable of self-government if they're given the proper education. Now, this reminds me of one thing that I had not actually planned to talk about, that is also, though, an interesting development in Lincoln's thought, I think. And I was careful to leave room for it in what I said a minute ago. Lincoln was in favor of political equality if the races lived together. But one thing I could have talked about, and that would a lot of people might find of interest, is Lincoln's views on colonization. You know, for most of his career, Lincoln was in favor of colonization, meaning we should abolish slavery and then get the African race out of North America. Send them somewhere else, like Liberia in Africa or Central America or some such place. And this is both good and bad. You know, the downside is most people are shocked that Lincoln would think that way. And does this prove that he's a racist, some people would ask. On the other hand, you know, he's a man of the times, and it's true that a lot of people at the time, like you were mentioning in England, worried about race war once you freed slaves, because the injustice done is so bad that you worry that there will be a spirit of vengeance. Could we really have that kind of community? Now, here's what you can say in Lincoln's defense on colonization, I think. One is, you know, when he would try to present the case, well, a couple of things. One is, when he talked about the inequality of the races, I think he was always very careful not to suggest that they were inherently unequal, right? In other words, he was kind of careful not to use racist language. Back in the 1850s, when Douglas would accuse him of favoring equality of the races, he would say, I'm not talking about establishing equality of races. He says the races are unequal, and if one has to be superior as a white person, I'm in favor of it being the whites, right? So it's a conditional statement. And he would say things like, I'm trying to remember the other one at one point he just comes out right out and says, is this just? He says, it may not be the only consideration, because we know that the vast majority of whites will not tolerate equality, and that makes it impossible. You know, but it's interesting that he would even raise the question, is it just that the black should be inferior? He's already raising it as a question. The other thing, though, about when he talked about colonization with certain African Americans while he was president, he just gave it to them straight out. You know, like the doctor, he says, look, I know you may not like this, but the fact is, my people will never treat you as equals. It's like, it's not good for you to remain here because it's just impossible. He seemed to have kind of a fatalistic view of that, right? That the races can't be equal. He says, look, it's bad when certain people have been enslaved, right? But think of how hard it is. This would be his attitude when you can tell by looking at who was enslaved and who wasn't enslaved. It is going to be impossible to forgive and forget because everybody will know who was on which side of the injustice. And so he thought, it's just not going to work out well if we try to live together. But again, to his credit on this, at some point during the Civil War, he had these plans for colonization. At some point in the Civil War, Lincoln met with a delegation of African Americans and tried to sell them on colonization. And they basically said, we're Americans. We've never been to Africa, right? I mean, we have no knowledge of that place. We belong here. And he gave up on it, said, we'll try it your way, right? I mean, it wasn't his first choice, but he was not going to, like, forcibly expatriate all the blacks. I don't think he didn't think that would be just either. Yeah.
On this topic, you know, one of the most fascinating relationships that's being studied now, apropos of colonization, is his relationship with Frederick Douglass.
Mm-hmm.
Was one of those. I mean, he absolutely blew his mind about colonization.
Yeah.
What was interesting in one of Lincoln's last White House receptions. Who does he invite for the reception on his arm, needing a mint, but Frederick Douglass?
That's right.
That's a relationship that's often, in that question overlooked.
Yeah. He shook hands with him. He brought him in. I think Lincoln was the first president to entertain African Americans at the White House. So, I mean, and again, Douglas was a kind of qualified defender of Lincoln after the Civil War. There's that eulogy Douglas did on Lincoln where he says, well, you know, he wasn't as ardent for abolition as I was, but then he was president. You know, he had to take it step by step in a way that I wouldn't have to. All right, well, let me see where we are on time here. Are there any other questions about this? It's about 8 o'clock. There must be some. Sure.
That address that you were talking about where Booth was there,
mm-hmm.
That was, if I'm not mistaken, there is a photo of Booth. They found Booth in the audience right above Lincoln. He could have shot him with a pistol right there.
Yeah, had he... I guess he only got the idea there. I think I've heard that, though. Yeah, and it was sort of extemporaneous, you know, I mean, well, not totally. Lincoln, it was obviously given thought to the policies, but it's not an extended speech. It was sort of like I think it was out in the open air, and Lincoln was like just going to give people some ideas about the direction he was headed.
The photo's
at the second inaugural. Oh, it's the second inaugural. Okay, okay. Yeah, which is a little bit before this.
Was he at the first inaugural?
I don't know. Now, there is a certain relationship between those two guys. I mean, Lincoln really loved Shakespeare, and Booth was a Shakespearean actor, and Lincoln had seen Booth in plays, and he had communicated through common acquaintances. I thought his performance was very admirable. Another really strange one, just while we're there, and like little facts of history, is that Robert Todd Lincoln almost fell in front of a train on a train platform in New York. And he was pulled out of the way by John Wilkes Booth's brother, right? He's like saved his life. So it was a small world, I guess. Let me think here. I think I have said everything I want to say in relation to the slides. I guess one other thought about Lincoln I had that I would, it's not really one that would maybe provoke a lot of discussion. But it's interesting that, you know, we teach young people in 2011 where there's so much information. It's interesting that Lincoln, as we talked about earlier, and he mentions, he's a self-educated man, clearly a very astute man. It might be useful to get students to reflect on Lincoln just as suggesting a different path. I'm just thinking of the fact that with the Internet, we all are kind of deep into this age of techno-information, and we can find out anything we want at any time. Lincoln was a guy who did not read a lot of stuff. He read a few things over and over again and thought about them, you know. He read the Bible. He read Shakespeare. He read some of the founding documents, and he read the newspapers to know what was going on. You know, he read Euclid and certain things like that to train his mind. But there's, I guess because of the technology today, our inclinations think, well, you got to accumulate a lot of information is one way to be wise, but Lincoln's way is more of like just meditating very deeply, I think, on a certain body of principles. All right, are there any other questions about the material, though? All right. If not, do we wrap it up? Okay. Well, thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks for
appreciate you coming so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
And a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Ha, 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 ha.
appear to be on. That's a bonus. It's a minute and a half past the hour, and the program is beginning. This is live. It is Friday on the front porch on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I've been away for a while. We last spoke last Friday, as a matter of fact, because I've been off bringing you through the good offices of our dear friend Dr. Bill O'Brien and the PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, West Virginia 2011 Summer Academy. An absolute adventure, in American history. And it has been nothing short of magnificent. Let me say right off the bat that if you did not hear Dr. Bill's lecture, address, whatever you wish to call it, of two nights ago, you missed a treat. All of these files will be going up at my page on White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org. That's where all the archives live. And you know, if you've just got a lot of stuff to do where you'll have time for some listening. Maybe you got to go out and mow the South 40. You listening, Dennis? Load these lectures up with particular emphasis on the offerings of Dr. Tom Tierney, Dr. Bill O'Brien, and Dr. John Kaminsky. Because if you are equipped with what those three gentlemen have to offer, you are absolutely girded in such a way as that no teabagger will ever be able to withstand the onslaught of your factual arguments. The information is that good, that real. Now I'm sitting. We're in a classroom down at Concord College at the Nick Joe Ray Hall Technology Center there. And I'm up in the back corner. The room is packed. Every seat is filled and then some. Because I got to tell you, it's been a while since I've been in college. But apparently, there's more of me than there was back in college. That, or else this relatively new building was designed for hobbits. And hobbits of no great girth. It's a little bit of a... But we're packed in there like sardines. It's good that the crowd is this big, because the idea that this kind of information is being made available, this kind of history, this kind of analysis, this kind of actual skull sweat is being made available to more than 50 teachers of history in the secondary schools of Southern West Virginia is heartening, to say the least. I won't begin to try to condense or to summarize any of what has been said thus far. That's what the archives are for. And by the way, there are also archives available for your viewing at our Ustream page. If you go to Ustream, that's the letter U followed by the word stream, ustream.tv, and simply search American History Seminar, bang, we will pop right up there. And you will have access to all of the videos. They've all been saved and annotated and noted and tagged and folded and spindled and mutilated. We've used no hooks. But they're all there for you. And if you will avail yourselves of them, you know, I've been saying this for months, and I hope some of you are checking this stuff out. Because I don't care how much American history you think you know, especially when it centers on the Revolution and the ratification of the Constitution and the philosophical underpinnings that gave rise to the urge for independence from Great Britain. And now we've moved into the 19th century. I don't care how much you think you know about it. You don't know what these people know. And it is being provided to you gratis. So do avail yourself of it. It is. Agnes sits here monitoring the stream so she can text to me if I'm screwing up or something. Agnes has been sitting here watching and listening, and I get these texts every now and then, just, oh my God, Bob, I can't believe what I'm hearing. And Bob, this is amazing. This is like water to a person dying of thirst. And several other of you have written to me along these lines as well. I especially commend to you, as I noted, Dr. Bill's remarks from a couple of nights ago. It's something special. For those of you who have been listening to the Horn for a lot of years, and we've been around for a lot of years, we've outlasted a lot of other efforts. But to those of you who have listened for a lot of years, you may recall actually listening to Dr. Bill when he was on the Horn. It was a couple of the best hours of programming per day that the Horn has ever produced. And to listen to Dr. Bill as he gets into the meat of his subject, and to hear and to just listen patiently and absorb the information, and then wait as he comes all the way back around and tidies it all up and ties it all together in an absolutely stunning peroration. You're not going to hear that anywhere else. You are not going to hear that anywhere else. So I hope you will avail yourself of this material, because it is magic. It is magnificent. It is soaring. And it's not the same old usual stuff you hear about American history. This is the stuff that the people who really sit thinking about this stuff talk about when nobody's listening. Only we are. You get it when it all begins to sink in and you realize, well, how can I put this? Hearing the United States referred to as a democracy will never strike you the same way again. You know, that's a word that we like to bandy about a bit. I even heard it in a clip from Prime Minister's Question Time from the UK earlier today when I was doing prep, and I had gone over to Crooks and Liars. Something's blah blah blah. Blah, 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 our democracy, blah, blah, blah. No such thing. And when the doors open and the light comes, the curtains get pulled back, the light comes streaming in the windows, and you realize that we have the Constitution we have because a lot of people in those days were afraid that democracy was getting out of hand. That there was just way too much democracy that had to be reined in, that the money was getting nervous. Well, you begin to see the rise and growth of America in a different light. Not a bad light, just a different light. A more realistic light, and we are, after all, a member of the reality-based community, right? Just checking. So do avail yourself of this. And I want to share an email with you real quick, right off the bat. Got an email from our buddy John. You've heard John a few times. John works, studies in the field of archaeology. I guess you would say he is the Horn's resident archaeologist. But he has a passion for history itself. And John wrote to me earlier this afternoon, and he said, "Hey, Bob, I've been catching the Prism series, and I am blown away by the quality of information that's being put out for free to anyone who tunes in. I think it is supremely important in this day and age when we have Bachman, Palin, Kane, and others putting out fake historical information to suit their own twisted ends. When people are armed with facts and a critical perspective within which to apply them, we can spot right-wing revisionism when we see it. And that, says John, is vital. He continues, so I'm thrilled with the Horn's commitment to broadcasting the Prism series, but I also realize that you're taking a financial hit by not being on the air every night. So I'd like to put out a contribution challenge for tonight's broadcast. I'll match your fundraising that comes in tonight up to the first $50. So if five people contribute $10 apiece, I'll contribute 50. If two people contribute 25 apiece, I'll contribute 50. The combination doesn't matter. Basically, I'll double the first $50 that come in. If you pull in $500 tonight, I'll still contribute $50. Limited resources, alas. Well, I understand. It's not much, says John, incorrectly. Oh, it's a lot, believe me. But for those thinking about giving a small donation, now's the perfect time because your dollars will multiply. John closes saying, hope you and the family are doing well, and thanks again for your efforts on behalf of all of us. Thank you kindly, John. Thank you very, very much. Because what he says is true. It's the 8th day of July, and thus far we have brought in about $155 for the month of July. That and those were critical. Well, I couldn't have gotten back to Concord to continue the broadcast series without that. And right now we're kind of the gas to get there Sunday night. So John's offer at a remarkably good time. So five members of the Thrifty 250 get their contributions doubled by John and his kind matching offer. Now, off to the races. It is Friday on the front porch. If we're doing this outside, we really would be under the front porch because it's raining rather steadily outside. Not Donder and Blitzen, not the chasms of hell yawning open or anything like that. Just a good, hard, steady summer's rain. The kind of stuff that sends gardeners and farmers out dancing in it. A soaking rain. Not the kind of stuff that just hits and runs off because it's coming down so hard, but the stuff that's sometimes referred to as a Scots mist. A soaking rain. So we would be under roof. So it's Friday on the front porch. And frankly, Appalachia, what's left of it, unspoiled and untormented, is beautiful in this kind of weather. Oh, it's wet, and everywhere you step it squishes. And the clouds seem to be just at treetop level. The fog itself becomes tangible and physical. And everything is shrouded in a sort of soft focus. So it's a lot of its sort here in one of the largest temperate rainforests on the planet. Now, I don't know what you've got on your mind to converse about this evening. Everything is... Well, everything but one thing is open to discussion. And I don't want to be an ass or anything, but would you do me a favor, please? Would none of you please... And I don't think I've ever put this kind of a limitation on Friday on the front porch before. And I don't really think I need to mention this, but just for safety's sake, because I don't want to run screaming out into the rain tonight. Could we agree at the beginning of the program not to talk about the crazy... The fact that Nancy Grace has not been dragged out into the streets and caned evades me. Could we not talk about the Casey Anthony case? And having said that, I will say no more. Now, maybe you want to discuss the recent issue of whether or not President Not Sure has decided to put the lives and well-being of 30 million seniors on the bargaining table. Well, not really on the bargaining table, on the menu, if you will. Maybe you want to talk about that. Maybe you want to talk about the ongoing and burgeoning it's more than a scandal. It's a sickening conspiracy that has been that has had the lid pulled off of it in the United Kingdom with regard to Rupert Murdoch. Maybe you want to discuss that, and I think that is I think that would be very, very good for us so to do. But before we get started, I got one thing that I want to go to because, well, damn it, it pisses me off. And I want you to have it at hand just so you can understand a little bit about the world that Appalachian people live in. There he goes again. Now, you want to hear this. I told you, I've mentioned repeatedly this recent health study that says the nearer one gets to a mountaintop removal operation, the greater the likelihood becomes that one's children will be born deformed and with various and sundry, six different categories, really, of birth Well, there's a long history of denying the toxic hell that coal has unleashed on Appalachia. You know, in the grand scheme of things, I can't help thinking that as my forebears were stealing the lands here from the native peoples who occupied it peacefully, well, mostly, they fought over it some, too. After all, the Iroquois Confederacy sold it to the Virginians, saying, oh, yeah, we've conquered everybody down there. There's nobody really there. No. Go ahead, take it. When the whole time the Shawnee were here and going, wait! We don't even like those people. So, yeah. But anyway, my people came in and stole the land. And it reminds me of the shortest poem that Robert Frost ever wrote. It's a poem called Forgive, O Lord. And we all know that my Scots forebears were very, very pious people. There's an old saying that the Scots landed in America and fell on their knees and prayed to God and then fell on the natives and prayed on them. It's pretty much true. There's another old saying that the Scots feared God so much they had no room left to fear anyone else. Equally so. But this poem by Robert Frost says, Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. It is a sort of recognition of one of those theses that runs the length and breadth of this. Be an almighty God, and almighty God be not some imaginary hallucination collective on the part of the human species. That if there be such a thing, he is a god of irony. It is a god of irony. She is a god. Peoples recognize this in their creation or their veneration of Coyote, Coyote God, who was a trickster. But with all that going as prologue, I can't help thinking that there was a little chuckle going on, cosmically, metaphysically, as my forebears dispossessed people who lived on the earth and didn't scrabble a bunch in it, unleashing all the poisons that lived underneath these Appalachian mountains. Oh, yeah, go ahead and steal that land. Do it. Oh, just do it. Go ahead. Yeah, because I tell you what, I'm going to unleash some shit on you. And it has happened. If you live near a mountaintop removal operation in Appalachia, your children have a 42% greater likelihood of being born with a variety of some six different birth defects. Brought to you by the coal industry. It keeps the lights on in funeral homes. But going back to the earliest days when coal miners would come out of the dusky, dusty, filthy, dank, damp, toxic environs of underground coal mines, coughing and spitting up blood and eventually dying of what would eventually be discovered to be black lung disease. Coal miners' pneumoconiosis is the formal term. The coal company said, "Nah, ain't no such a thing. We're good, honorable businessmen. We're just digging up the coal that's keeping the Industrial Revolution a-turning and a-going." They denied black lung even existed. "Ah, them's all smokers. They smoke, everybody." You know, the coal industry was the first industry ever to suggest that cigarette smoking was bad for you, but they only did it to evade their own responsibility for killing people with coal dust. Coal dust is bad for you. It's toxic. It's terminal. So, flash forward, and we get this new study regarding birth defects near mountaintop removal operations. At first, the coal industry said, "Well, you know, we ain't had a chance to study it up enough yet. We ain't studied on it. We ain't got the checks out to our own paid little prostitute researchers who'll blame it on something else. We ain't ready to comment yet." But, you know, that's probably not true. That's how them liberals are. All the time trying to make up stuff that gets in the way of business in America. It ain't real. Well, they've outdone themselves. Earlier this evening, when I was outside getting in the rusty red pickup truck to toddle down into town, as is my wont before showtime, just to sort of walk around, blow, you know, that kind of thing, I looked around at those skies that were hanging at treetop level, as I mentioned. It's beautiful. And I thought, gorillas in the mist. Well, it's not really gorillas in the mist here in central Appalachia, but apparently, as far as the National Mining Association is concerned, it's something close. Hillbillies in the mist. Now, like I said, we're going to have plenty of time to talk about whether or not Barack Obama is... has put a lot of us on the menu, or whether he's playing us. We'll have time to talk about Rupert Murdoch and any number of the myriad stories I missed in my absence. But this one, just I got to get this one out front just so you can know what we're dealing with here, what kind of an outlaw, sleazy, slimy, filthy, disgusting bunch we're talking about in the form of the coal industry, and in this case, the National Mining Association. It's been a couple of weeks now since the story came out, and I guess the coal industry has had a chance to have a look at it. And in response to the fact that mountaintop removal causes a 42% greater likelihood of a wide variety of birth defects in children born in Appalachia, well, the coal industry's looked around for a loophole. And by God, they think they've found it. Sit down. No, really, sit down. You're going to love this. The National Mining Association has now criticized the birth defect study, and shown its invalidity as follows. Yeah, just so you can, just to remind you of what music's playing there. You know what's coming, don't you? This is a quote. This is a real quote. Boy, howdy, would I like to find the author of this here quote. I'd like to find him about 2:30 in the morning stumbling out of a bar somewhere in, I don't know, Georgetown. The National Mining Association has announced that the birth defect study is flawed. No, really, is flawed. Because why? Well, like I said, this is a quote. The birth defect study is flawed, according to the National Mining Association, because, and I quote, the study failed to account for consanguinity. That's a $10 word for incest. You know, you're my sister. You're my sister. I'm your brother. I'm your brother. Hee-wee! The study failed to account for consanguinity, one of the most prominent sources of... That's right! The National Mining Association just said every hillbilly with a deformed birth baby has that deformed baby because we're a bunch of inbred goddamn hillbillies who don't have enough common sense not to get it on with the relations. You know how it is. Deeper kin, closer in. Closer kin, deeper in, something like that. Y'all come back now, you hear? And clean up your mess. Now, doesn't that just kind of take your breath away? I mean, how's that for some straight-up gall? And guess what? Every elected representative I've got is probably by now on board with this quote. The study failed to account for consanguinity, one of the most prominent sources of birth defects. Well, damn. That's it. Just incest. That's why. You know how it goes. All those vascular birth defects, all those cardio birth defects, all those pulmonary birth defects, all those endocrine birth defects, all those brain birth defects. It's just incest. It's because Jethro couldn't keep off of Ellie Mae. And there he was, a rutting on my mailer. Dang, you know. Just dang. So I hope you can understand why I delayed by a couple of minutes our discussion of whether or not we're on the menu. We are. And whether or not Rupert Murdoch is a sleazy slime ball who should be dragged into the street and caned. Because he is. I hope you can... Because, you know, we tell jokes on ourselves here in Appalachia. But I'm damned if we much care for having others offer them up as serious fact. It don't play well. It's kindly sick, if you know what I mean. Yep. It's all just inbreeding. I thought so. Pardon me for just a minute, lest we have some kitty engineering here. Sit on my lap, Mushu. You'll be going back in the house later, as soon as we take a break, which we're going to do. I want to make, as they've rolled in, first of all, we are $30 toward John's $50 challenge. And News Ninja Susan sent in a note. She said, I'll add to that challenge up to an additional $100. Bless your heart, Susan. Thank you. You didn't need to do that. So now it is on. If we can bring in $150, it'll turn into $300. Now, that's making your money work. So there you have it. And I hope you'll pardon my little bit of frustration at being called an inbred hillbilly by the National Mining Association. By God, if we had a few million listeners here, we'd have letters going out to the National Mining Association saying, why hadn't that dirty little son of a bitch that wrote that been fired yet? I mean, my God, they called their own workers a bunch of inbred hillbillies. Did every birth defect in Appalachia to inbredness, to inbreeding. Right? Yeah. No, that's not an audio defect you're hearing there. That's a cat that's very happy to see me home. She's decided she's going to be a stole this evening. She's around my neck. So we got to take a break. We'll come back to your phone calls 28 minutes before the hour. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
By the time you were born, there were four other siblings, with your mama waiting, your daddy in jail, and your oldest brother was away at a home. And you didn't meet him till you were old. Old enough to know better. Old enough to know better. But you took to his jawline, long sandy hair. And he made you feel like none of the others. And the way he looked at you touched you deep down in there. So you jumped up and rolled into the sunset, but the sequel, it started with the next morning sun. And the dew on the bike seat, and you all aglow from the love he put in you and life on the run. So you moved to a small town, and then to another. Into another with another on its way. And you both swore to God we'll keep it together, and the state wouldn't take your babies away. Now the district attorney said he might have forgiven, had lots of reasons to turn out this way. You both go to jail for them four little babies you made and delivered along the way.
Patron Saint Band of the Horn, that is the Drive-By Truckers. And, well, forgive my macabre sense of humor. But, you know, that little dedication, the deeper in, goes out to the National Mining Association, who thinks that everybody who lives in Appalachia is an inbred hick. Nice people, that. That's enough of me. It is Friday on the front porch, and let's go straightways to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob.
Brother Albert.
Buddy.
Doing okay?
I don't know, that kid Ferg looks a lot like you. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, but he looks a lot like Agnes, too, so that, you know, that's a good thing.
Like her, too? What's going on? Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
How will the National Mining Association ever explain that, Brother Albert?
Oh, my God. They're so filthy. They never end. You know, I just got back from our little trip that we took with the family to New York, did the museum, and I'll get to all that in a second, but on the way back, I saw a sign that almost gave me about 2 hours of rage and fury. I didn't even need to drink one of those 5-hour energy drinks. This is on the way back through Pennsylvania. It said, "The wind dies, the sun sets. Coal keeps the lights on."
No.
Yeah. I mean, it was the only one I saw, so.
Where?
In Pennsylvania, like in the heart of it.
Yeah,
so I was like, here they come, advertising up here. You Amish boys want jobs? There's probably a few mountains up there with a layer or two in there, maybe, you think?
Yeah, we could longwall it, or, contour mine it. That's another one of their fun lists for mountaintop removal, contour mining. Yeesh.
Yeah, they are filthy. And they'll use
I can just see Hiram and Lemuel on those D9 caterpillars now.
Well, yeah, boy.
And I'm sure the National Mining Association wouldn't, when it gets there, the National Mining Association will be more than happy to trot that back out, Albert, and say, well, I mean, my God, look who, it's the Amish.
Exactly. I mean, well, you know, that's if these liberals, they keep, you know, trying to put regulations on fuel, you know, maybe we'd be able to turn coal into diesel fuel. We wouldn't need horse and buggies and all that stuff, you know.
Just spoiling all their fun.
Filthy liberals. Anyway, yeah, they're disgusting, these people. I can't take it anymore. I did take the girls, little troopers. We did about 85% of the Museum of Natural History. Not a whole lot of whining, a lot of enthusiasm. It was a good thing.
They had to be thrilled inside that building.
Oh, yeah. It was really cool, too, because we had taken them down to the water, the sound.
There were bugs and rocks, right?
Oh, yeah, there was horseshoe crabs. They're in their season to mate, so you see them, you know. And they're in, you know, and I say to them, like, what is that? I'm like, oh, that's an ancient creature called the horseshoe crab. Now, horseshoe crab didn't stick, but ancient creature did. So when they saw them embedded in the rock, the ancient creature! Yeah, so that worked.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was pretty fun. They had an absolute blast. We took them to the Tenement Museum. So if anyone's in New York, we're all immigrants here, right? Aren't we in this country? You gotta go to the Tenement Museum. You gotta take your kids. It's an amazing place. It's just an amazing place. It's just unbelievable. Where you get to see what it looks like in 1916 and how it feels and so on and so forth. If you're gonna go to Ellis Island or anything, if that interests you, you definitely must do the Tenement Museum. Anyhow, here's the thing that bugged me about the Museum of Natural History. It was a great place. There were some replicas. That was a little bit of annoyance. One thing that really just got to me though, was, you know, like every one now and then, in a little corner here or there, you'd see a sticker in a dark corner with no light on it. You'd look around, wouldn't light even pointing to it. It wouldn't be talking about species and extinction. There was a brass on the floor, and there was a light on that on the floor. And so it would talk about in the sixth extinction. And then you walk up to the Margaret Mead exhibit, right? And there's just bunches of people up at the Islanders, and in the back is a Moai, you know, from Easter Island, Rapa Nui.
That
place we've talked about many, many times.
That little laboratory experiment for what we're doing to the planet right now.
Amen. This is why I love you, Brother Bob. You know this instantaneously, and I look because I'd like to, I'd like to at least look and see what they have. Not a mention of what and why and where they went and what they turned into. Nothing, not even a peep. So I had to make sure. My twins were apart. One of them was with my dad, who was up in the front, and the other one was with Renee, and they were kind of lollygagging in the back, you know, the reed maps of the Native Americans in the exhibit right before. So, yeah, it took them a while. But once I got, I think it was Rice, it was the first one, I made sure I explained to her, in the front of the crowd of all these posing tourists, loudly enough so they would hear it, that how they are an example of what not to do, of how not to treat the planet, because literally, stop carving these frickin' things, and they wind up destroying their entire environment, and they went pretty much extinct. Into what, Cook or one of those dudes found them, and, you know.
Well, yeah, and there's that.